In case you are not aware, there is a handout that I prepared for this presentation on the chair back there by the door. So if you don't have one yet, make sure you scoop one up before they are all gone. Are there some left back there still? All right. I'm astonished at how many people are here. I thought this topic was so narrowly focused to such a small slice of the school of rhetoric teachers that there would be four calculus teachers in here and that would be about it. So you're scaring me. Oh, the cat's meow. All right, it's 9:50, so I'm going to begin. But if someone could tell me, if you have the schedule in front of you, I actually don't know what time this talk is supposed to end. So I'm not usually clueless about my own schedule, but if someone's looking at the schedule there, can tell me what? 10:50, so it's a one-hour presentation. All right. That's no problem. Be plenty of time for questions, I think. So as you can see, I have a much more interesting title on the screen than I do in the materials there that are in the conference manual. We're going to talk about a skill that students have to learn in mathematics that starts actually around in the early algebra days, but comes to fruition and into major importance in pre-calculus and then to even greater extent in calculus. And this skill is the skill that can be the showstopper for a lot of students who have memorized their way through every math course they've ever had and got an A at every single time. And then when they confront the task of express this variable in terms of these other variables, they can just have a wreck and stop in the road and say, I don't even know where to start this problem. So we're going to unpack the cognitive process that students have to go through to express one variable in terms of others in certain complicated kinds of geometrical situations. And I want to introduce you, if you're not familiar yet, I want to introduce you to an analytical technique called concept mapping that is something I learned in graduate school, and I don't use it every day or anything, but I found when I was working on this that it suddenly came in really handy. So I want to give you that also. All right, so let's just paint a picture a little bit. All right. In my opinion, this skill is of critical importance. You're going to suffer in pre-cal, and you're going to fail calculus if you can't do this. All right. So if you're in calculus in high school, which is not everybody, of course, but still, it's a lot of students, you're going to fail it if you can't express one variable in terms of others. Okay. Plays a major role in calculus. Calculus actually is not that hard. I mean, it's just rules. You just memorize some rules. It's easy. What's hard is setting up the problem. It's easy to do an integral. I mean, there's only a couple of different ways they go, and you just memorize some antiderivatives and some substitutions, and the rest of it's just like a little adding and subtracting and inserting values and stuff. Calculus isn't that hard. What's hard is if you can't develop the expression to put into the integral, which requires you to express one variable in terms of others, if you can't do that, you're dead in the water. The easy part of just following the rules to execute an integral, you can't even get to that because you can't set the problem up. So it's of crucial importance. This skill can be particularly taxing because students are not always given a diagram to look at. They might be given a verbal description, and they might have to just figure out for themselves from a verbal description what what needs to be done. And that is challenging to some students, okay? But we just need to make, just need to adequately assess what we're asking of students. Not everybody can just visualize your description right off the bat. So that's another thing we have to contend with. The process of expressing one variable in terms of others can be so challenging to some students that that we as teachers need to make sure that we are starting to address this very early in the curriculum. I mean, pre-algebra even, with simple little linear expressions. But in pre-cal, it needs to be one of our major things that we just park on all year long. It pops up throughout the curriculum in pre-calculus, but I found that teaching pre-calculus for the last 13 years, 12, much more devoted attention needs to be applied to this than what the students will get just by encountering it occasionally in problem sets. We need to be a lot more intentional about it. Finally, in my introductory remarks here, the higher you go in the curriculum, the more kinds of problems we have available. I mean, once you get to trigonometry, you have a whole new realm where you can do this. And one of my favorite problems, which is not a difficult problem, but I have so many students, I've just seen them just stop in the road. In the trig book I've been teaching out of, there's this problem where you have a lighthouse offshore, and it's got a rotating light beam. And if you imagine a line perpendicular to the shore going out to the lighthouse, and you measure, the problem gives you the rotation rate of the light beam and the dimensions, you know, of where the lighthouse is relative to the shore. And the student's supposed to express the position of the beam spot on the shore as a function of time. Now, this is a tangent function, so you have a limited domain here. So we just go from where the light strikes the shore perpendicularly, call that t equals zero. And then, of course, it's going to go to infinity because it's going to leave the shore. But before that happens, so before 90 degrees, so before 90 degrees occurs is the limits of this problem, just the first quadrant. But I've seen students just completely choke on this problem. They don't even know where to start, okay? So, but that's just a lovely little problem, and it's not that hard. So let's think about the cognitive process that happens when a student is confronted with this task. That's what I want to talk about today. I'm going to use concept maps to illustrate what we need to know, and then I'm going to use a diagram that I developed to trace through the cognitive process that students are going to have to follow to effect a solution. And I'm going to do that by using three example problems that are kind of fun. Okay, concept mapping is what I'm going to use to talk about the math skills involved. And this concept map that I present to you is going to be a concept map of, it's going to be a two-part, functionality and then separately the skill of expressing one variable in terms of others. All right, so here's a concept map that I developed for this purpose. At my high school, they call me Lord Laser because I run the laser optics lab there. It also means I get to do this, you know. So this looks a lot better than it did in my classroom the other day when I went to make sure my iPad was going to work with this Keynote technology. It's really sweet. But I went up to the school to check it out, and my projector in my room apparently is uh, not working very well because those orange things look like mud. I'm glad to see that the colors are nice and pretty here the way I wanted them to be. All right, so the two yellow ellipses are the two major concepts that we're trying to diagram. So a concept map, you start with a concept, you put it in a bubble, and now you start thinking of all the things that relate to this. And you just draw them connecting into other bubbles. Any concept that relates to other concepts, all right, you should connect them together. So you end up with this web of connecting links. So when you think of the concept of functionality, which is certainly a concept high school students struggle with, I wish we had a pill you could take, a function pill. You eat this, kid, and after that, you'll understand what a function is. Until we have that, we're just going to have to continue to be deliberate about not assuming too fast that students get functions, because they don't. So we need to really work on that ourselves. But when you think about functionality, what are the concepts that relate to that, that you need to understand if you're going to understand functionality? Okay, well, certainly one is domain and range, a pair of words that students can't seem to ever figure out what to do with. Mapping is another concept that relates to the concept of functionality. In fact, I was talking with one of you, I think, this morning, or maybe it was yesterday, and I said, a nice verbal question that you could put on one of your pre-cal tests would be, what is a function? Answer the question 3 times and don't use any words in the first one or the second one or the third one twice. Only conjunctions. You can use them twice. You can have the word and in all 3 answers. But your technical terms cannot appear in more than 1 answer. I want 3 independent explanations for what a function is. If I was told to do that, I would use the word mapping in one of my answers. Okay? Would our students do that? Would it occur to them to say, oh, well, it's a mapping of one variable gets mapped onto another variable? Okay? But I think of mapping when I think of functions. Another thing I think of is the idea of the way one quantity varies with another quantity. Variation in proportion is what I call that general field. What does that say? Constants? Can't read from here. All right, so functionality involves, that relates to proportionality, of course, constants of proportionality, but constants are things that students also get hung up on. They don't know what to do with them often. They don't readily notice that when there's a constant in a linear equation in front of the independent variable, it's the slope of the line you get when you draw a picture of this. Okay. I mean, they will eventually admit that if you coax them to it. But they don't often just jump to that, you know, like we would want them to. And certainly variables is a notion that connects to the idea of functionality. And this is another one, representation of unknown variable quantities by the use of a letter that can stand for any value that this variable can take on. Okay, so these are some of the things that relate to the general concept functionality. Now up here I've got another concept, expressing one variable in terms of others. Now, what relates to that? Well, for starters, the whole notion of functionality relates to it and everything that goes with functionality. So I've got a big connecting line here. Okay, but there are more things involved in the art of expressing one variable in terms of others than just the theoretical understanding of functions. Okay, there are things like the geometric relationships between variables, distances, angles. Okay, there are trigonometric relationships between variables. There are algebraic relationships between variables. Maybe one's a square or a square root of another one. Okay. So there are all kinds of different relationships that we can encounter. And when we solve these problems, you have to use everything all at once. At least if you're in pre-cal, you're going to use algebra and trig and geometry all at once. All right, so now we're going to begin the process of saying, okay, I as the teacher have laid out this concept map so that I as the teacher appreciate what prerequisite knowledge needs to be here in the student's mind before we can even contemplate the task of expressing one variable in terms of another, all right? And why do I need to know that? Because I don't want to be guilty of calling upon a student to execute a task that they are not prepared to execute, okay? I want my students to achieve and know success when I give them a problem to do. It might be slightly beyond them, but that's because I know they can get there and the struggle is going to be good for them. But I don't want to set up the student for failure by giving them a task to do that they're not equipped to do and have them just collide with a brick wall and collapse on the floor crying and go, I give up, you know, I hate this class. Okay, I don't want that to happen. Okay, then it's all damage control after that. I've ruined the cooperative effort that has to be there for the student to trust me that I know what I'm doing. You can do this. We're going to get there together. Trust me, I am not going to kill you. I'm not leading you into the forest to leave you there and run away. We're going to get there together. But if they fail because I haven't appreciated what goes into the task, they can lose trust in me, right? I don't know how many of you have experienced this, but I have. If they lose trust in me, then for the rest of the year, they don't believe me. When I show them something that looks hard and I tell them, you can do this. My students do this every year. They will be going, you're such a moron. You know, that is way more than I can do, and I don't like you anymore. And I don't want that, okay? So I want to appreciate the skill set that we have going in. Now, let's look at a problem. So we're going to do three examples here. The first one's really easy. This is a test problem that I've used in the past, right? Actually, this is an actual calculation that I performed back in my engineering days. Okay, we have worked in a process plant in Baytown, Texas, Exxon Refinery. And we needed to know the volume of the airspace in a vertical tank. But the measurement we were making about what was in the tank was the liquid level in the tank. Okay? This is not hard, okay? So if you're thinking, gee, that looks pretty easy, you're right. This is an easy problem. I'm starting with an easy one. But it's not all, this is not just straightforwardly easy to all of the students. For some of them it is, but not for all. All right, so we got a diagram here. Now, this problem, I drew a diagram for our purposes here so we could talk, but when I put this on a test, I don't give them a picture, okay? This is one of those ones where I don't give a picture. I say it's a vertical cylinder. So that's not hard. Vertical. It goes this way. So this cylinder, we have got let's label the vapor space in the top part of the tank, V, because that's what the problem is going to ask me to do. Express the volume of the vapor space, V, as a function of the liquid depth, D. I like to tell my students the variables that I want them to, the letters to use. It makes the grading easier if D means the same thing for everybody. So I give them this tank, all right? And here's the task. Express the volume as a function of the depth of the liquid. Not the volume of the liquid, but the volume of this vapor space above the liquid. Okay, so this is what we've seen before. I put the problem up in the corner. And now, here's the cognitive trail that I'm going to kind of walk us through, all right? I wish I could go over and stand in front of it, but I have to stand in front of this microphone, so I feel a little trapped and held back. I like to wave my arms around and walk around, but I can't do that. All right, so we're going to start here. Right here is the boundary between the theory that we're bringing to this problem and the application. Looks like my battery is going on my little laser. It sure is. That's too bad. All right, so I'll have to go verbal. All right, so the next orange box is a restatement of the problem. Here's our task. Express this volume in terms of a certain depth. Now, you can see that blue arcing arrow. It says, this is the solution process. So this is the solution pathway. In other words, this is the set of cognitive steps that the student has to execute to get to the answer. What I want to know is, what are the key insights that occur along this pathway? And where do key kinds of knowledge enter in? So let's walk through it. So the first blue circle says the volume of the cylinder is pi r squared times the height. That's going to be the first thing you need to think, right? If the problem says express a volume in terms of something else, the first thing you should think is, well, how do we calculate a volume? And what is this anyway? Oh, it's a cylinder. Okay, pi r squared times, we would say L, but this thing's vertical, so let's call it H for height, all right? That's the first thing the kid needs to think. Right off the bat, we have some geometrical relationships, okay, the pi r squared area of the circle and the volume of the cylinder. Right off the bat, we have to know those. If we don't, we're not going anywhere. Okay, the next thing is to start playing with the notion of the volume. Well, he wants the volume of the vapor space in the top of the tank, and clearly that's going to relate somehow to the volume of the liquid. Well, and so probably the volume of the whole tank is going to come in somehow. So let's write that down, right? So the volume of the whole tank, that's going to be pi r squared times 40 because the tank's 40 meters tall. All right, what's the next thing needs to dawn on you? And that just continuing to play with the volumes. Okay, I've got the volume of the whole tank. I guess I need the volume of the liquid. So, that's pi r squared times d because the liquid depth is d. And here's the key insight for this problem, which is not a difficult one because this is an easy problem, but that is that the volume he wants is the volume of the whole tank minus the volume of the liquid. So the difference is the volume that we're after. So I've labeled that the key insight for this problem because it's downhill from here. I've already figured out the volume of the whole tank and the volume of the liquid. All I have to do is subtract them, factor out, you know, pi r squared. And then, so for the given tank, the pi r squared works out to be 113 using three significant digits for this calculation, which is what the data in the problem are given. I always tell my students, just as an aside, in my math classes, if I give you an abstract problem like prove this trig identity or something, okay, if numbers occur in those kinds of problems, I want pure numbers, okay, pi and so on. Thank you so much. Thank you. Who do I return this to? You, okay. Thanks. Cool. I'm back in business. Lord Laser once again. Rides again, I should have said. I tell them, though, that if this is an application problem, you have physical objects with measurements. Hello, measurements have precision. Look at the precision in the given information and make sure your answer is consistent with that. In other words, use the right number of significant digits in your answer. Can you tell I'm a science teacher? Okay, but science and math, okay, and it's all about integration, and I don't let them get away from it. I tell them, yes, you of course we use the right precision in your answer, and your units of measure as well. This expression is rather meaningless without units of measure. Okay, now there's one more thing we can talk about, which I'm not going to do on every example because I don't have enough time. But there's one more thing we can talk about, and that is, and this is should be talked about, and it should be stated in the problem that you give to the students. Go ahead and tell me the domain and range for this function that you just set up while you're at it. Okay. It needs to be clear to the students that the domain, the depth of the liquid, it physically has physical limits. It can be zero, can't it? Zero, it can be. And it can be 40 if the tank is full. Okay? So we have inclusive domain there, 0 to 40. And for the volume of the vapor space, now it's a volume units, all right, and cubic units, and the volume of the full tank is one end of the spectrum, and the other is zero if the tank is full of liquid, all right? All right, so that's our first example. Now, before we go to the next example, let me just mention a couple of things we can do here, okay? You can diagram problems like this. You can use these diagrams when you're talking in your math department about skills that we are noticing that our students are struggling with and how we can address them at different points in the program. This doesn't happen very often. Teachers like comparing notes on what's weak in our program, but I think it should occur much more than it does. We tend to just be in our little room doing our little thing, see each other in the coffee bar, etc. But we can do a lot better job of comparing notes and saying, gee, is there something I can do in Algebra 1 that would aid the pre-cal teacher down the road? Okay, how can we work together on this? The more problems like this that you sort of think through and diagram out, the more aware you will be of the kinds of obstacles that come up when students are solving these problems. Okay? That means you can also, with specific problems, cases that you have in your solution, in your problem sets, you can coach your students better if you already know this chain of reasoning that they have to go through. Now, I don't want to belabor the point, but it's so common, I think, for math teachers to solve the problem and have the solution and be sitting there going, so solve the problem, Janie. Oh, I don't even know where to start. Well, okay, let's see what you got. Okay, how often are we actually aware that you have to go through this specific chain of reasoning and there are key insights that have to occur to you, and if they don't, you're stuck. And there's key knowledge you have to bring to this activity before we start, okay? So what I'm advocating is that if you're aware of this whole apparatus that has to be in place, it will enable you to work with your students and coach them more precisely. Well, let me see where you're starting. What would be the first thing you might want to think about, you know? I'm waiting for the student to say, well, the problem's about volume, so I suppose I should start thinking about the volume. Uh-huh. Do you know how to calculate volume? Of what? Well, what's this problem about? Okay, start to coach them, but I'm waiting for the brick wall to happen. I need to know where the brick wall is in the student's mind, and I need to know that brick wall is there already. I need to know where they are. Which one are you hitting against? So if I have diagrammed these problems out like this, I can coach my students through because I know already where the danger zones are. It's like an obstacle course where I already know where the mud pit is and where the barbed wire fence is and stuff. And okay, which one are you stuck at? Because I can get you past it once we find out which one you're stuck on. And here's what I was saying a moment ago. We need to cooperate between math teachers at different levels. All right, so if you're a pre-algebra math teacher, seventh grade, pre-algebra, I think you should be aware of just what happens to students, the sweet little girls who, and it's almost always girls who do this. I don't hardly ever see boys do this. Boys are either really sharp and they just do everything, or they're slobs and they just go, yeah, whatever. But for girls, there's this middle group. They're not geniuses, but they can work with meticulous, mind-numbing levels of effort and give you a document that looks like it should be enshrined in the Smithsonian, and they get a 95 on every test. They're just massively successful, and then they hit problems like this, and wham, they can just melt. I don't know where to start because they've been memorizing all their lives, just by working every problem 100 times, because one of the test problems will be one like this, and I've already seen it, okay? But won't it be helpful for the pre-algebra teacher to know that kids like that when they hit this in their pre-cal class, they're going to cry. They're going to cry a lot at home. And they're going to come in and cry. They're not going to get the 95 on the pre-cal test that time, okay? They're going to get a 60, and life will be ending, okay? There goes the GPA, college plans, everything. All right, so I want that pre-algebra teacher to know this is what lies in store for this girl 3 years, 4 years from now. And how can you start now in seventh grade giving them activities and being deliberate about the fact that this skill is so hard? I need to be conscientiously calling it to your attention over and over and over and over so that over the years you're getting better and better. You're more and more skilled at this. Algebra 2 is a big place where a lot of this should be happening. And I kind of mentioned this already. You're in your lessons, in your specific one-on-one tutoring time, you're using your knowledge of the logical structure of this problem to target your tutoring with them. All right. So let's go to the example number 2. I like this problem. It's not that hard, but the key insight phase is a lot less obvious than it was in the last one. So, I'm sorry that these diagrams are very, very tiny, but I gave you in the handout a set of like 10 of these kind of problems with the solutions written out, and I think I also put at the top of that problem set that if it's not there already, in a matter of days, that file will be available on my website as a free PDF. You can just download it. If the reproductive quality there is not up to snuff where you can't read it, just go to my website here, novarisscienceandmath.com, and go to the free resources tab, and it should be posted already, but if it's not, it probably will be by the time the weekend is over. So this problem, we've got two circles inside of this. They're touching one another, and they're sitting inside of a rectangular boundary, and the rectangular boundary is touching the circles on both sides. And we need to express the width of this rectangular boundary in terms of the radii of the two circles. Okay? Express x in terms of R1 and R2. All right, so don't freak out. I've got another slide that expands the working part of this picture, but I wanted to show you all of it on one picture first. So all this is down here is the functionality concept mapping that we've already discussed. And up here is the problem. And here's my boundary between theory and application, just like I had before when my laser ran out of battery. All right, now what I'm going to, the next slide, I'm going to take the working part of this picture right here. I'm going to expand it as much as I can so that we can see it a little better, all these little tiny letters on the slide. It's a total violation of PowerPoint presentation law, this slide. I'm aware of that. Okay, so here's the problem statement, that little orange circle right there. Express x in terms of R1 and R2. So what's the first thing that needs to occur to you? Express x as a sum of dimensions I know and others I don't. So let's see here. Here's a drawing to kind of see how we can get started. It doesn't require too much insight to realize that from the center of the big circle over to the left side of the box, the distance is R1. I mean, that's pretty obvious. And from the center of the right circle to the right side of the box, that distance is R2. Okay, so I already know these two dimensions. It's the part in the middle that I don't know. So let's start by expressing x as a sum of the things I know and the things I don't. So R1 plus R2 plus this part in the middle, and I'll just call it D, the distance, the horizontal distance between the centers. Okay, we're off to a start. The problem said to express x in terms of R1 and R2. I've already got a start on that, but I can't have d in there. So that's where the work needs to go. So here's my intermediate description. So now I need to start thinking about this d. The variable d is related somehow to the distance between the centers of these circles. I don't know how yet, but that's the next thing that needs to occur to me, is I need to start thinking about geometrically the distance between the centers of these circles. And now we come to the two key insights that if you don't get, you will not solve the problem. And the first one is, the distance between the centers is R1 plus R2. I mean, most people will get that, but it will take a few seconds for that to lock in. You just stare at the picture long enough, and you'll see that, well, if I mentally rotate the R1 and R2 lines around so that they're in line with each other, collinear, boom, R1 and R2, the distance between the centers. Okay, good. That's not the dimension I want, but at least I know I'm starting to figure out how D relates to R1 and R2. But here's the real key insight, is to notice that the Pythagorean relation is the relation that gets you there. Okay, so I took the little circles here and I blew it up larger so you could see a piece of each circle. A Pythagorean triangle here, right triangle, connecting the centers. This hypotenuse is the R1 plus R2 that we already hit on in the previous insight. And then the legs of this triangle, one of them is D. That's the thing I'm after right now. The other one, if I think about it, I can see that it's R1 minus R2. It's the difference between the radii. It gives us that height right there. Once you see that, you're good. It's all downhill from here. We put this information into the Pythagorean relation, and we solve for D, all in terms of R1 and R2, and then we just insert that into the equation that we had back at the beginning, and we're done. Okay, so I would call this problem sort of moderately difficult for most students. Doable, but there are some insights that are going to take some students some time. Not everybody in the class is going to solve this in 2 minutes. There will be one or two kids who do. And then most of them are going to take a few minutes to sort this out. And some might get stuck on it for quite some time. If they don't notice these two things, they could stall out. They could work on it for 15 minutes and not get there. And now they need to have some kind of reassurance that it would be valuable for them to press on. They don't want to. They want to just give me another one. Maybe that'll be better. So it's, somehow you have to persuade them that there's a lot of value in exercising the discipline to press on, even though you'd rather go do something else. All right. On our way to the last example, I suggest that you develop a working set of problems of this kind that's appropriate for the grade level that your students are in, and that you repeatedly go back to this throughout the year. Okay? Have it at the beginning of the year. Like, this is my set of problems. And now I would like you guys to work on the first two over the next week or so, and we're going to see what happens and talk about them in a week or so. And then as the year goes by, be very deliberate and intentional about saying, okay, remember that problem set I gave you back in September? I want you to go work on number 3 this week. And just add that in to the general work, okay? In other words, take this skill, which is so crucial, and lift it out of just its embeddedness in the chapter problem sets and make it a theme that you come back to over and over again throughout the year. Like I said, the problem set that I've given you, along with the solutions, the handwritten solutions, is available at my website, novarescienceandmath.com. And when you find cool problems that you can add to this, put them on your set and send it to me. too, so that I can develop an even larger and richer set of problems. Now, of course, any of us could go sit down and extract 50 of these problems from our math books right now. So, but some of them are really interesting. Okay? The next one I'm going to show you, I think, is a very, very interesting problem. And its simplicity is so deceptive. So here's our hardest example I've saved for last. Given an equilateral triangle with base 1 and an inscribed rectangle with height h, express the area of the inscribed rectangle as a function of h. I love this problem. I don't know where to start. All right, so here's the concept map and the solution path. So, right here, the first blue bubble. Okay, so we need to think about the problem asks me to develop a functional description for the area of a rectangle. So obviously my thoughts are going to start with thinking about how do we calculate the area of a rectangle. That's not hard. Okay, so it's base times height. So they already gave me the height. That's called h in this problem. So what does that say up there? We'll call the width of the base of the rectangle. We'll just call it x. Students need to learn that sometimes you have to make up your own variables to call things by. I'm not telling you everything. You got to deal with the base of this rectangle, and it's not labeled. So make up a letter. That happened in the previous, the first problem too, right? I had an R in there in that cylinder, but anyway. Sometimes we have to come up with our own variables. All right, so the triangle. I've got x and h. Once I multiply those together, I'll have my area. So now what do? Now we need to think about this triangle thing. Okay, the triangle is an equilateral triangle. What does that tell me? Okay, I'm the kid. I'm thinking about this, right? This is where I need to stop and think. What does this tell me? What is significant about this problem in the fact that he told me that the triangle is an equilateral triangle? This is hard to get to, but the first thing that needs to dawn on you that the meaning of this is in the fact that this is a 60-degree angle at the corner. Because I know things about 60-degree angles that will help me solve this problem. So this is one of the key insights. 60-degree angles are standard angles. I know the trig values for the 60-degree angle. Okay. And moreover, I know that the trig values are actually ratios of the lengths of sides of right triangles. How is this going to help me solve the problem? Let's redraw the problem with the 60-degree angle in there. I've got my x shown now for the base of the triangle, my h for the height of the, sorry, base of the rectangle, and the height of the rectangle. And let's see. Now, with this little right triangle in there, the 60-degree right triangle, to move forward here, I'm going to have to make up another variable. I need a letter to designate the laser. What? Obviously, I have a very magnetic personality or something. I'm sucking all the photons out of these things. So I will point. What does that say down there? What's the letter on the bottom of that triangle, the 60-degree triangle? Is it an A? So I'm at a too of an oblique of an angle. I can't see it, and it's too small here to see. So anyway, the 60-degree triangle now has an opposite side side opposite the 60-degree angle called B, and a side adjacent to the angle called A. And labeling it that way, it starts to maybe become clearer that the tangent of 60 is H over A. But I know the value of the tangent of 60, or at least I can work it out, because I know the sine and I know the cosine, and all I have to do is divide those. All right, so if I do this, I will have a value for A that's expressed with H's and constants, right? Have eliminated the A and have only H's, which is what the problem requires. So I'm showing the math there. So I don't memorize the tangent values. I never tell my students to memorize the tangent values. Just memorize the sines and cosines and know how to divide them to get a tangent. Why memorize the whole tangent table? It's easy. So square root of 3 over 2 divided by 1 half, root 3. Another reason I don't memorize the tangent values is because I can never remember. You know, they're too similar. 1 over root 3, which is which. It's not intuitively obvious to me like the sines and cosines are, which are getting bigger and smaller in a very easy way to predict. So I just divide them mentally. So H over A is root 3, and that means A is, what is that, H root 3? H over root 3, yeah. Okay, well, I've arrived, right? It's just mopping up at this point. So X, I was told, is, what does that say? Oh, that's the function from up top. So X is, from the previous. So X is equal to the base of the triangle minus 2 of these A values. I figured out A in terms of H. So that's 2H over root 3. So I subtract that, and I've got the and then I multiply by the height of that rectangle, and I've got my expression for the area. This problem is just a lovely exercise in this art of expressing one variable in terms of others. It is, its simplicity, I think, is part of its beauty. Look at all the stuff that the student has to associate to solve this problem. I mean, it's all there. The algebra, the geometry, the trigonometry, all of it. And a couple of really important key insights that if you don't see them, you're stuck. Which, if you know this as the teacher, that this is where he's going to get stuck, is associating this equilateral triangle with its 60-degree angles and having it dawn on him or her that I know a lot about that angle that can apply to this. And if I'll draw a picture and start labeling things, I might be able to fiddle my way to a way to express this X variable in terms of triangle stuff, which I know, okay? If you know this, you can help the student get over that threshold if he gets stuck there. There are some problems on that problem set that I gave you that are easy, and there are some that are really hard. I think on there somewhere is my favorite one, which is to calculate, it's like it's a gasoline storage tank problem. Underground horizontal cylinders that are used to store gasoline, and the guys who measure how much is in the tank by sticking those long poles down the hole, all right, they get a wet, it makes it wet on the bottom, right? So when they bring it up, they know the depth of the liquid in a horizontal cylinder. And what we want to know is, well, what's the volume of liquid that that corresponds to? That is a hard, hard problem. So the solution to that is arduous. So I think I have that included. But I enjoy working it out. And I don't assign that problem in a sort of military way, you know, do it or fail. I put that one out there to the students as a challenge problem. I think if you really want to be exercised, you should try this problem. And a few of them will. Most of them won't. I encourage all of them to exercise themselves with problems like this, okay? Because this is within their capabilities. It'll stretch them a little, but it's not too, I mean, it'll stretch them. But the horizontal cylinder problem is fierce. I guess most of you know by now that I have a booth and a company, Novari Science and Math, so I just want to mention it, that I have various resources for science and math teachers, which I hope you will learn about and I would love to talk to you about. And so that's the conclusion of my prepared remarks, and we have, I think, 11 minutes left. So if you have questions or comments, would love to get into them. Paul, right? Yeah, well, this logical sequence that I wrote up here is obviously a model where I've tried to be as explicit as possible. And so the human mind, of course, being as complex as it is, there are many other ways you could probably represent this solution strategy as things might occur to different students. So I'm just trying to chart out what looks to me to be like the main thoroughfare of how your associations would need to occur for you to get moving toward a solution. Certainly, students might jump boxes without explicitly denoting something. You know, they would just intuit that, oh, well, obviously there's a 60-degree angle here, so let's go get to work on the trig. Without actually denoting that specifically to themselves. So, what I was trying to do is, this solution, this cognitive path might not even be exhaustive. I mean, of course, I don't have all the time in the world to sit around drawing these pictures all the time, so I'm trying to get down what appear to me to be major things that need to either occur to the student or just kind of intuitively deal with, but this is where we have to go. I'm looking for the major things that can trip them up if they don't notice. Yes.
Kind of along those lines, I'm looking at this idea in terms of teaching chemistry and physics.
Ah.
And I'm thinking, okay, if I teach them a specific pathway, then should I expect them to do it that way, or should I allow them to choose a different method as long as they arrive at the same answer?
Oh, I would definitely allow them to use whatever pathway occurs to them. I have seen students in my physics class use radically unorthodox methods to arrive at a beautifully correct answer. And their methods are so unorthodox that it takes me a long time to grade their test because I have no idea what they're doing. I had a student just this past year who is almost artful at this, whose work would go up the side of the page, and he would write formulas down that I thought had nothing to do with the problem, and in more than one case, I marked his whole solution wrong and subtracted the entire point value of the problem, feeling bad for him to meet a 60, only to have him come up to me and explain his solution to me and show me that it was totally legit. I, that's embarrassing when that happens, but it's also part of the joy of being a teacher is watching this kind of stuff happen. These are just such cool people, right? Being made in the image of God is such fun. And for that kid to think like that, I mean, I learned a lot about being a student, being a teacher, solving problems just by having that kid in my class. So I would, what I try to do is help students have a structure of techniques and ways of thinking that will help all of them get on the road to solving the problem. And I try to show them the way I think about certain problems when they're confusing to me. And I try to always tell them, these are the kinds of problems that are very confusing to me. So if they're confusing to you, that's fine. Don't freak out. Okay? I hate these problems. They're really confusing to me. Sometimes I have to depend on the units of measure to help me figure out the solution. Because otherwise I get too confused. And then I tell them, well, this is the beauty of the units of measure. If you'll just keep the units of measure in place and figure out which one do I have to divide by the other one to get the answer to come out in kilograms, oh, it's this way, you know. They can be your friend. So some people, those problems aren't so confusing. To me, they are sometimes. I encourage students to use whatever works for them as a way to solve the problem. I just try to give them some reliable ways to start so that I don't have this mass, you know, everybody sitting there going, I don't know where to start. So, yes, ma'am. Uh-huh. The one who memorized their way up to pre-cal with all A's? The way I tutor students, now first of all, I haven't tried everything, but even if I were to continue trying things, I don't know that I would get to the point of showing this slide to my class, okay? It would probably freak them out. So, I would probably draw this information in a different way, perhaps, when I'm tutoring an individual. I might say, let's make a list down the side of the page of the things that you know. Let's just start listing what you know, which is really doing this, but it's in a different way that makes more sense. You know, they don't know about concept maps. So, what else do you know, with a problem like this, tell me what you know. Well, I know the area for a rectangle. Okay, what's that? Write it down. What else do you know? Tell me everything you know about this problem. Okay. Eventually, hopefully, they get to, well, it's an equilateral triangle. Yes, you know that. Okay. What do you know about equilateral triangles? Well, sides are equal, 60-degree angles. Great, great, great. Write those things down. The equal sides thing doesn't come into play here, but the angles business does. So what I am trying to do is when I'm tutoring a student, is not tell them the answer, okay? And this is frustrating to them sometimes. Just tell me the answer, Mr. Mays. I came in here to learn how to solve this problem. Just show me how to solve the problem. But see, my attitude is I already did. I already taught the lesson. I already went over the homework. I already reviewed the principles. I've already done that. Showing you one more time is probably not what you need, even though it's what you want. And it would be easier for both of us if I just granted your request. But that's not what you need. What you need is for me to comfort you and support you while you force yourself through this barrier that's staring you in the face, because that's the cognitive exercise that you have to learn how to do. I just need to love you while you're summoning the courage to do it. But the way I try to do that is to try to discover specifically where the barrier is for them. So I say, please, work the problem for me out loud, or watch, I'll watch while you write, or you talk to me and walk me through the solution and go as far as you can with it. Don't just walk in and say, I can't work number 14. Show me how to work number 14. No, you show me how to do number 14 and we'll go as far as we can. And when you hit the brick wall, that's when I'm going to start asking questions. And I'm going to target my questions knowing what the brick wall is and where the student's breakdown has happened. And I'm going to try to ask enough questions to help the student to have the aha moment that they need to have. That's my goal. If I can't accomplish that, then eventually I'll have to tell them, did you notice it's 60-degree angles, and you know the trig values for that, and that will relate to the solution here. Oh, I never would have thought of that. Okay, you need more experience, because now you know. If you see a problem like this, you might need to think about how the angles relate to the solution you're chasing. Now you know. So I try to help them pass the barrier without telling them the answer. And I have learned the hard way from tears and parent conferences. I have learned the hard way that I need to be very careful when I do this, because it's very frustrating to some of the students, and they can start associating meanness with my tutorial technique. And I'm not being mean, okay? I'm giving you what you need. Just like God does when he gives us hard trials, okay? It's what we need. He's not just being a meanie. It's 10:50, but let's just take a couple of quick questions, or if I don't get to your question, you can certainly come talk to me. Yes, sir? I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me. What's the... Let me have a look. The one below that with the arcs inside the square,
that's crazy.
That is a world championship hard problem. Wow, what a problem. If you can solve that problem without looking at the solution that I wrote down, you can feel good for the rest of the day. It is colossally difficult. Jeff, you had a question? Okay, yes. Right. Uh-huh. Well, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Don't just sit there staring. If you can get your pencil to move and label things and write down everything you can think of that you know, the juices can start being stimulated. Yeah. Well, if you have other questions or would like to talk further, please stop by my booth, and thank you for coming.